Double Pod. Y'all know me, Nathan Schwartz. Joining me from New Zealand, Dylan Williamson.
Good morning, Nate. Congratulations on your championship.
Thank you very much. I'm glad we're starting out with the congratulations, because I'm 90% sure that Aaron doesn't have some BS excuse to why he's not here. He just didn't want to celebrate the Lakers with us. I'm 90% sure that that is the reason, and we'll find out when he listens to this.
He called in sick, but I think it may just be a really bad hangover from consoling himself after watching the Lakers absolutely obliterate the Pacers to win the in-season tournament.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure Sacramento got down to a balmy, frigid 50-something degrees, and he had to get some hot chocolate with some Rumple Mints in it. So he's probably feeling that one. You don't have Rumple Mints where you're from, do you? Yeah. It's just a hangover in a bottle. It is one of the strongest mint liquors out there. You feel it. But we finished the in-season tournament. How did you feel about it?
I thought it was a massive success, right? Like the biggest issue that the NBA has really is that there are too many games and the games don't really matter. You get to a certain point in the season, you get that big burst at the start where everyone's excited for it to be back. And late down the stretch with this seeding, it's exciting. And that's like 40 games. You know, that's like half the season. And then the other half is like not really that exciting. Like, you know, it's one out of 82 games. It doesn't matter that much. Teams are resting players. They're not giving it their all in most cases. And so the in-season tournament was a way to get them to actually care and to make basketball with stakes in the middle of the season. And like LeBron, you know, was taking charges, setting screens, cutting to the rim. Absolute like vintage LeBron performance. Like he cared, the other players in the tournament cared, and the coaches cared. And that's the biggest thing, is that these guys cared about this, and it made for some really good basketball. And so I think overall it's a massive success.
Yeah, I was doing some history digging on like just basketball playoff history in general, because prior to the NBA, not all leagues had a championship. It was kind of common, actually, for some leagues to just play the regular season. Whoever had the best standings at the end was considered the champion of that league. It's an anticlimactic way for the league to end, but so it was. And then they introduced tournaments, championships, and they had to incentivize players to play for that. So they put in this cash incentive, and back in 1947, when we had Joe Fulks winning it, it was like a $2,000 cash prize, and he was on a $10,000 salary. So it was like a fifth of his salary to win the championship. And so, yeah, guys went very hard to try to win championships. We still have cash incentives for these guys. When I was looking into that, it's close to like $6 million for winning the title or being on the title winning team. Yeah, that doesn't get discussed much, does it?
No, it doesn't, yeah. Yeah. Especially for like some of these role player guys, or like these guys on, you know, buyout guys on veteran minimum. Like that's freaking huge.
Yeah. I mean, we always talk about the guy who like gives up taking a $10 million salary to take like a $3 million with a contender. And that's just like a bet on winning. Cause if you win, you get that money back. I'm fine with this just being a tournament for a cash prize. That's all tournaments ever were. And then as they went on, we started having this prestige. We established rings culture and started making that be like this defining thing for a player. I think we can do that with the in-season tournament. I don't think it needs other things beyond that. Would you add an incentive, though, after having watched it?
I mean, like, I don't think it needs it. The big thing was just, will the players actually care and will they actually try? And maybe it's like a form of league-wide leadership from LeBron that he's like, I'm going to play like this matters now that, you know, sets a standard that actually like this is an important thing. This is something to play for. You should try and, you know, put it all on the line for this. Don't hold back. Don't rest. Give it your all. LeBron, the oldest player in the league, went out and did that and, you know, made it a big deal. And so hopefully that's enough to carry it through, that they don't need additional incentives. I think that the players actually do respond to the cash, which I wouldn't have thought that they would. You know, like that's always been the sort of go-to incentive, is like, oh, we'll just give them some, you know, a few dollars. And it's like, I didn't think that that would like really matter to LeBron, who's making $100 million a year, you know, to get another $500,000. But he at least said that it mattered. You know, he got asked about taking charges.
Like it mattered.
And like even down to, you know, he straight up said, you know, I will take charges at my age this early in the season for $500,000.
Yeah.
And so like, I think it was enough incentive. You know, when the format was first released, I didn't think it was going to be that good. You know, I much preferred the idea of like a guaranteed top four playoff spot. Thought that would be really interesting. And maybe that's like the type of incentive where it could take it to an even bigger level, where like some of these teams, like the Lakers, who are a lower seeded playoff team, could really benefit from that. But they offered them cash. The players played really hard. They put their bodies on the line and played like it was a playoff game. And so I think there isn't a need to change anything from there.
Yeah. There are definitely some differences when you look at like LeBron's stats in and out of the in-season tournament, like the other regular season games versus just the in-season tournament games. NBA.com allows you to filter for in-season or in-season or just regular season. And like all of the in-season stats for LeBron are up. All of the in-season stats for Anthony Davis are up. That is not true of everyone. So, you know, it might not be an overwhelming success. I do think LeBron winning this is setting the stage for the in-season tournament MVP to be named the LeBron MVP post his playing days. We've already got the...
Could we even get just the LeBron James Cup?
I really think it's going to either be the David Stern Cup or...
It's the Adam Silver Cup. That's why he hasn't named it yet. He's like, no, once I retire, they can name it after me.
They can name it after me. I think either the Stern Cup... Or they're just going to go with some financial backer and it will be like the Taco Bell Cup. And I really hope they don't do that because that'll be lame. But
yeah, actually, I wouldn't mind that. I think it just needs like a better name than the in-season tournament.
Yeah.
Like the what in-season tournament? Like we know what it is. Like give it a name. Like NBA Cup, I feel like is enough if that became like the main way of talking about it. You know, it's an NBA Cup game.
The moniker.
Yeah, I think that's enough. But in-season tournament is just it doesn't quite have a ring to it.
IST is not doing it for you.
Yeah.
All right, I wanted to pitch you a couple of my ideas for how we can improve the IST in the future. First, let's play it by divisions. No more of this wacky, wild draw from the previous year. Yes, there will be some divisions that are more loaded than others. But on the plus side, that also means you might get, you know, some lesser division sneaking someone in, and then you have one of those wild card teams in this best, you know, single elimination tournament. I think that could be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I mean, probably the main argument that people will make is like, well, some divisions are better than others. Like imagine having to play through the Pacific, for example. But some of these freaking tournament brackets became incredibly unfair because it's based on the previous standings where teams are not the same as they were last year. It's like there were certain pools that you could point at and be like, oh, the Celtics got a really easy bracket. Like they're going to walk through this. Like, oh, the Lakers, they have quite an easy bracket. They should be able to pull it out. So like the NBA's way of making it competitive and making fair brackets didn't necessarily succeed. And so I don't think that should be an argument against it. I think probably the biggest problem would just be, would it become too repetitive if you're watching the same team sort of play each other in the cup every year? Would you like to see some of these teams that aren't playing each other as much, you know, really good teams get an opportunity to go at it earlier in the cup?
So I've been thinking about it. How would we kind of differentiate it from the playoffs? And I don't think they're ever going to mix the cup up and go like East and West for the groups. That doesn't make sense. It's a group stage with both conferences. Although it would be an excellent opportunity to try that, especially if we're going to have this neutral stage. So either way, you're going to be stuck in the Western Conference. And then if you're not going to see him here, you might see him in the playoffs. I think going with the divisions at least gives you a chance to like build some regional rivalry. And with a potential chance of us having two new teams in the near future, instead of doing five teams per division, we then have 32 teams in the league. We could go to having four divisions of eight teams each, and you play them each seven times. So my second change would be that we need more games in this. Just the seeding round, the round robin, the group stage, whatever we want to call it. I feel like four games is not a very good sample size. I either want to double that so we have eight games, or if we have divisions of seven, eight teams, let's just go to seven games.
Yeah, that sounds fair enough. Like one of the reasons for having other than obviously it's just to get the most money, but one of the arguments for having an 82 game season is that the more times you play each team, the more sort of fair the outcome is. So on any given night, you know, your best player might, you know, have a freaking off ankle night. Sprain.
Yeah.
Or an off night. And so the more times you play, the more representative that sample size is, and you get a truer outcome of the teams winning games. And so the more times you play your pool games, the better teams in theory should more clearly rise to the top. Maybe the argument is that, do we necessarily want those better teams rising to the top? Like, sure, it makes for maybe more competitive knockout stages, but isn't it interesting to see a team, you know, have one upset game and then all of a sudden they're through to the playoff or to the knockout stages?
Did you watch the Pelicans Lakers game? I'm just saying that.
Unfortunately, I did.
Because the Pelicans, it's hard to say they upset the Kings when that's their third victory over the Kings this season. But I think we would say that the Kings are on a higher level than the Pelicans and have a greater playoff or championship odds than the Pelicans. And they took out the Kings and then they got waxed by the Lakers. And I think that will happen in single elimination games. I mean, it happens in series, but you know, that you just have to be prepared for that. And then,
yeah,
what was it, Thursday night that game was played, and that was just kind of a dud.
Yeah, and the Lakers just could not miss a single shot, which is why we have 7-game playoffs as well, because you can't repeat that multiple times over the course of a series, unless you're LeBron playing the Raptors. Like, it's going to balance out, but it is what, you know, kind of adds an element of variance and randomness and more excitement to these knockout stages, that, you know, any team can get hot for one game. Unfortunately, it happened to be the better team getting hot, which compounded their advantage.
But, you know, the Pacers got hot and took out Milwaukee. They took out Boston. That was really exciting. I was not going to be sad if Indiana won this, like, as happy as I am with the Lakers won, wearing my Lakers back-to-back champ, the 2009-2010 championship hats. Like, I was really happy about it, but it was also really fun watching Tyrese Halliburton kind of hit that new star level. So, you know, I think there's a should be a fair amount of randomness. You know, this is not going to be the grand championship, but it's like a fun mini championship that is enjoyable.
Yeah, and like we said, and like Adam Silver said, it's all about adding stakes to these games that otherwise wouldn't have them.
Yeah.
Single game elimination is the most stakes you can possibly have in a game.
My third change, and I don't know if this is a change so much as just like an idea I heard that I really liked. And that is, do not have this every year in Vegas, but instead have it rotate around the teams, or have teams apply for it in the same way they apply to host the All-Star game. You would lose the idea of like having a neutral court, but man, if this took place in Detroit, Michigan would love basketball again. I'm sorry, but like, it's hard to love basketball when you're watching the Pistons, you know, night in, night out. You get these games where, all right, you get to see Bucks play Pacers here, they'll sell out that arena. It would be really cool. There is a chance that, hey, maybe one year it does land on a team that also is good for that tournament. But I feel like you could, you know, you could figure a way out about this. Like, hey, if you won the lottery, you get the in-season cup in 2 years. Good luck getting there. But like, you know, just some sort of way of like, if you were a really bad team 2 years ago, now you're going to get the cup. And this way we help keep fans engaged. Also, we could move it, and I don't know how international you want to do, because you don't necessarily want to fly everyone over and back and all that, but this could be a really cool thing to have in London or in Paris, or, you know, I saw Abu Dhabi thrown out there. It's a cool idea in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing, I guess, for the location is that they just need really good crowds. It needs to feel special, needs to feel like a big deal, and it needs to, you know, have a large crowd, which is one advantage, I think, of having it in Las Vegas, where you've got, you know, a reasonably high level of interest locally, fairly accessible for,
incredibly,
you know,
a lot of
NBA markets. You know, it's easy enough to go, you know, even if you're a Lakers fan, to, you know, you go to Vegas for a couple of days and watch the in-season tournament final. Like, that's not the end of the world to do. And I do worry about, like, would it feel as special if it was in, pick on a random small market team city? Like,
sure.
If this was in Charlotte, would it feel as special? I don't think so. I think that having it in that Las Vegas venue, you know, it feels special.
I will just say that here in America, we do our college national championships in Indianapolis, And people go crazy about it. People fly from all over. I had a cousin fly from Los Angeles to go when UCLA was in there. Like, people find ways to go to these things if we can get enough excitement. So I just think that this would be a really nice way to engage basketball in some of these other cities that, like Detroit, aren't getting to experience it. Imagine, you know, Sacramento years ago, like during their drought, would have been really nice to have competent NBA teams be there.
Yeah, and that could be beneficial for the NBA as a whole in some of these cities where, like you say, the local team isn't so compelling.
Mm-hmm.
You do get to see good basketball, which you maybe haven't done in a while. Say Charlotte, for example, like you get high level basketball that they haven't experienced in quite a while.
Sure.
Sorry to just keep picking on the Hornets.
Yeah, let's be fair. They deserve it. And we said nice things about Brandon Miller last week, so you know. They got a brief reprieve. Now, one of the things you messaged me about was wanting to do a all-in-season tournament team. And I thought that was actually an official thing. I thought they were going to do it. I thought we were going to talk about like who they put, who we put. They did not. Do you have an all-in-season tournament team?
I do. It's a little bit tricky because of the like kind of smaller sample size.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, with teams playing potentially so much more or so much fewer games, and then waiting on the importance of the knockout stages. But I think we start with the, I think, deserving MVP, which is LeBron James, who had a pretty phenomenal run and kind of felt like he was sort of on the back seat in the final, just like, okay, keep going at Anthony Davis, and then once he loses it, I'll take over. And just never needed to take over, but definitely felt like he was kind of cruising, ready at any moment to be like, right, this is my time. And, you know, the Pelicans game was absolutely ridiculous. Like, there was just nothing they could do with him. He was getting every single thing that he wanted. Play, you know, defended Zion. That was potentially a matchup issue for the Lakers. Is like, who do they have defend Zion? Like, you don't want Anthony Davis on him. It takes away your rim protection. You don't want, you know, Torian Prince. He's not strong enough. Well, LeBron's like, I'll solve it. I'll just guard him myself. And then also, you know, make every single shot that he takes. And so I think he's the clear headline, the MVP of the in-season tournament. And I think, you know, he won it officially, and I think he'd win it by my standards also.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised just with how great of a game Davis had. You know, a lot of times when you have these voting in things, it kind of just goes to whoever did best most recently. Like the MVP award, hey, whoever played good in the final 3 weeks of the season usually gets it. Finals MVP, if it's a close race, usually whoever played good in the clinching game gets it.
Yeah, yeah. And we see that in like the NBA finals, is because it's decided right at the end of the final game, mm-hmm. that like a lot of times that game seven will like really skew the opinion of the voters.
Yeah, but looking at the numbers over their seven game in-season tournament win streak, as I'll call it, LeBron James 25.5 points net rating, so plus 25.5 points per 100 possessions over the seven. No, you shake, did I get my numbers
wrong? Shaking my head because that's ridiculous.
Yeah. All right, I'm like, I got this off NBA.com. Are you you cleaning the glass or something? Which, hey, fair. They won a lot of these games. The Pelicans game was a blowout, which really helped those numbers, although he played like 23 minutes in that game. Davis plus 18.2 net rating. LeBron, 26, 8 boards, 7.5 assists. Davis, 23 points, 15 boards, 3 blocks. Like, both guys were absolutely outstanding. I think LeBron is definitely deserving of one of our all in-season tournament team spots. Davis is deserving of the other one. And then I know Haliburton, it was a rough final game. Like, what, it was at 20 points and 11 assists, which dropped his scoring and passing down to 26.7 points per game, 13.3 assists. And it raised his turnovers. He had 3 turnovers in that tournament game.
Oh, my God.
He averaged 2 throughout his tournament run. Like, I think those 3 are absolute locks for all the in-season tournament team. Who else would you put in here?
Now, this is where it gets hard. You said that you could find, this is what I've been doing this whole time. You said that you had easy access to player stats filtering by the in-season tournament.
Yes. Well, I would not call them easy. Because if you go to NBA.com and you select player index and then select on one of the things, it gives you the official leaders and you can't pivot it. If you go to NBA.com/stats, choose players traditional stats, then you can change from season type to in-season tournament. You can also flip this around to go like advanced stats and whatnot. But if you just go in the front door or the easy access, the leaders and points per game, it locks you in and won't give you that toggle option. So annoying to look at.
Very bizarre. I'll see if I can find it. I thought Giannis played pretty well, even though they got knocked out. Maybe the stats say otherwise. He was the next guy for me.
I struggled with Giannis a little bit, just in the fact that he has actually played better in non-in-season tournament games. Like looking at the averages, looking at the numbers, I thought he played very well to take out the Knicks. Although Julius Randle somehow cooked, which is not things that I traditionally say about Julius Randle. And that is Giannis's man. So I kind of held it a little bit against him, but he was like my sixth guy, so I wouldn't hate it.
Okay. Okay. Who were you thinking then?
So I really liked what De'Aaron Fox brought. He was second in points per game in the tournament with 34.5. The only guy that scored more than him in a per game metrics was Donovan Mitchell, and Mitchell only played in two games. So I think it's might be fair to call Fox the best scorer of the tournament. Also, 7 assists and 7 boards came in huge in a couple of the Kings group play games. What he did to close out against the Warriors, I thought was really important in that game to secure their seeding. Yeah, they did come up short against the Pelicans. That's been a rough matchup for them all season long, but I don't have a lot of other options here, felt like.
Yeah. I mean, like, the instinct is to select someone from one of the semifinal teams.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't know if there was any single player who was, you know, sort of most impressive. Like, did Jason Tatum really have a great run? I still can't find the stats, but not off the top of my head. I don't think there was any single Pelican who had a great run. Whereas Giannis, I do remember playing fairly well.
And really, my other debate was between Giannis and Jokic. And Jokic's team went 2-2. They were dealing with the Murray injury. They had a couple other absences. Jokic still put up 32 points, 16 boards, and 11 assists. And I'm just like, you know what? If I can't get someone else who would really help lead his team anywhere, I'm going to go with the guy that put up really good numbers and didn't lead his team anywhere.
Yeah, fair. Maybe I just watched too many Bucks games, but I felt like Dame was pretty good too.
No, Dame was excellent. Like, he's hot and cold, but I want to say that his hot games were more of the in-season tournament games. Where's Lillard's stats? I have here. I want to say it was like 62% true shooting in the tournament. Ah, Dame Lillard, 69.9% true shooting during the tournament. So, you know, very hot shooting in for Lillard. A lot of free throws, but, and that's one of the things that he's great at, is getting to the line.
Nice. Sorry, who was your fifth player?
I went Jokic, Davis, Jokic, LeBron, right. Halliburton, and Fox. So 2 guards, 2 forwards. Well, kind of. 2 guards, 1 forward, 2 centers. It works. They're going positionless for the real ones. Hey, who cares?
It's a made-up award, okay? We get to select the format. And I select very strict position by position. To qualify, a player has to play at least 90% of his minutes at that one specific position.
Good luck finding that. Good luck. All right, so you went with the same big three of Davis, LeBron, and Halliburton. I feel like they
were... Yeah, the three easy ones.
Yeah.
And I kind of like my Bucks duo, even though they didn't progress that far.
Yeah, they progressed as far as anyone else before rapidly imploding. Like, Pelicans rapidly... You can't put a Pelican on this. I'm sorry. That game alone disqualifies.
Can I put Herb Jones on for playing really good defense in the quarterfinal?
No. No.
I put all my stock into Herb Jones to carry me through to the championship.
To be fair, Herb has to do so much. And I don't know what you do with the Pelicans and what you do with Zion. And I was thinking this earlier in the season where I think they were playing the Hawks and he wasn't getting up. And then he blew past someone and had like a really nice highlight dunk. And I was like, oh, maybe it's just in bursts. Maybe he can't do it all the time, but he's still working his way back into shape. And then he played good against the Kings. I was like, okay, maybe it is this. And then against the Lakers, which the Lakers are a bad matchup for him. They have so many 3-4 wings. Like Cam Reddish, more of a 3 than a 2. Torian Prince is a good 3-4 wing. They brought back Vanderbilt. Like they had endless wings to throw at these guys, but he just looked really bad. And I'm not really sure where the Pelicans go, because when they're clicking and hitting, they look unstoppable, but they don't do that often. They've got two guys who are best at driving and attacking the basket, but aren't really that good at passing. Ingram, Zion, they're both fine, but you want them both to be better to be like your primary guy. I'm not sure where they go at this point.
Yeah, they to spoil a segment that we'll get into later in the show, they do suffer from quite poor roster construction. Like the pieces don't necessarily fit that great.
Yeah. Man, now I'm worried that if we do team of the week and we spin, we get the Pelicans. Like, ooh.
Let's go.
Just deep diving in the Pels. Really, actually, if Herb can become a consistent shooter, like that would be huge, because right now you need Herb for the defense, but you need Trey Murphy for the shooting, and you can't play both of them, Zion, Ingram, and CJ, and Val. Like, you can't have six guys on the court, and you kind of need six to make their lineup and rotations work.
Mm.
Just not enough rim protection without Val, not enough ball handling without CJ. Well, yeah, but you got hurt.
I guess something's better than nothing.
True. Well, moving off of in-season tournament, unless you have more in-season tournament thoughts, you got any more takes? How'd you feel about the Knicks?
No, I don't have Knicks takes. Come on. let's talk about the Lakers.
That's where I was going to transition.
Fantastic. Does this prove anything to you? Do you think this is a meaningful indication of the playoff quality of this team?
I wouldn't exactly say that this tournament, so much as things that happened around the same time of this tournament. Rui coming back from injury, looking good, makes me very happy. And Jared Vanderbilt finally getting healthy. The Lakers are really good with Vanderbilt on. They have a plus 21 point differential with him playing, like per 100 possessions. They dominate teams. He's holding team, or when he's on the court, the Lakers are holding teams to 101 points per 100 possessions. In very small sample size, part of which heavily inflated because it was against the Pelicans. But this is what the Lakers need. They need a defense and some identity that can hold up around on the rest of the team. And his early play coming back, Rui's play coming back from injury. Christian Wood is now out of the lineup, and that makes me both sad and happy at the same time, because like he is out because we have people playing better than him. It's not like he is out because he was absolutely atrocious and god awful. It's just like Jackson Hayes is actually providing valuable defense and rebounding, and these other guys are playing well. So I'm willing to put the Lakers back into the contender conversation, which I had not had them in before the start of the season.
Yeah, and I agree with you that like it's not just the tournament win, but it's coincided with a time where they've sort of figured out a lot of things. And you know, the biggest thing is that they've really figured out their rotation. Cam Reddish, like joining that long list of players who are almost out of the league and then join LeBron and then simplify their role and just become really valuable role players. Like he was the primary defender on Tyrese Halliburton in a game that the Lakers won because of excellent defense, primarily against Halliburton. And he defended CJ very well. If he was basically CJ McCollum, basically non-existent in their game against the Pelicans. And so he's become just like a really good on-ball defender. Playing at the two guard, being a guy 6'8 with really long wingspan, creates a lot of difficulties for opposing offenses. And then you get Torian Prince, who I made fun of as being a shit shuffle guy, a theoretical 3-and-D player because he looks like he could play defense, but actually has never played defense in his life. He's learned how to defend. he's joining that like, you know, he's taken up the J.R. Smith role of just never played defense in his life and then becomes a role player on a LeBron team. And he's like, yeah, it'd be really good if you could defend. He's like, oh, okay, I guess I could do that.
Man.
And like he guarded Brandon Ingram really well. Brandon Ingram's a really good scorer. And Torian Prince, who hasn't played defense a single season in his career, came out and has become a real 3-and-D player. And that's exactly what the Lakers needed. This is why I was dubious of them coming into the season, is that they had all these guys who on paper could be something good, but they actually are developing into those actualized real versions of themselves.
And just another guy that's kind of moving along that trajectory is D'Angelo Russell. Has had a number of good defensive games, and he is playmaking fairly well, low turnover rate for him, especially just over the course of his career, hitting 40% from beyond the arc. Like, the role players are all kind of doing what we expected them to do. Or not expected. They're doing what we hoped they would do. Now, are they doing that because it is December? Maybe. Does all of this go away later in the year? Maybe. But, like, hey, Rui had that insane three-point shooting in the playoffs, which was like 50% and or something. He's 40% over the course of this year, over 14 games. Like, I'm starting to get enough volume that I'm trusting his shot. Yeah, it'll be streaky. He'll have a bad game where he goes 0 for 3 or 1 for 4 or something. But, yeah, I think it'd be pretty consistent. Like, he's only shooting 3 of them. But, like, hey, 1 for 3 every night, I can live with that. That's really nice to have from your backup power forward.
Yeah, and the other thing that separates this team from sort of recent Lakers teams is there's always been a lot of options that they can go to, but in previous seasons, like, they've all been bad. You know, it's like, oh, we've got all these different options. Maybe we'll throw Wayne Ellington in. And it's like, okay, he's also unplayable. Trevor Ariza is also unplayable, and so is Carmelo. And, you know, these guys that
we don't install Ariza. Ariza got a ring with the Lakers. He's forever Laker family.
All right. But they go from all these options of guys who all suck to now, if D'Lo isn't having a good scoring or decision-making fourth quarter, take him out and you play Austin Reeves at point guard.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, Rui isn't playing consistently, just don't play him. You've got Vando, you've got Prince, you've got Reddish, you've got all these other options of guys who, if one guy is not filling their role properly, like, you've got other options that you can go to. Even like a Max Christie, who
is a little rough,
but who Darvin Ham trusted in a in-season tournament, but still a finals game, a final. He put him in there for a few minutes to be a valuable defender. And so they've got options. But the biggest thing I think in favor of their contender status is LeBron has proven that four stretches, he can still be the best player in any game. And Anthony Davis on both ends of the floor. Yeah. And Anthony Davis, who, you know, is one of the most inconsistent superstars in the league, who we ranked as a top 10 player. And then last week said he's probably more like a top 20 player. He just went out and absolutely dominated both ends of the floor in the final.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're talking about other Lakers contenders, if you get LeBron playing the way that he did, and you can get a couple of these games, like, it doesn't need to be every night, but if you can get a dominant defensive and offensive game out of Anthony Davis in the playoffs, and then have guys who can make shots in Taurean Prince and D'Angelo Russell and Austin Reeves and guys who can defend and Cam Reddish and Max Christie and Vando, you do have the foundation of a contender.
And not just to keep piling on the Lakers love fest, which I am loving right now. but we have enough competent pieces that we're able to push Austin Reeves back to the bench where he does so much better. And, like, sometimes guys are just better and more efficient off the bench. And this is one of my pushbacks whenever someone says, if only this guy played on his own team, he could be a star. He could be a James Harden type guy. That is not true of everyone. And as many times...
It's your anti-Manu take.
It's an anti-Manu take. It's exactly what we saw with Jordan Poole. If Poole got to his own team, he could break out. No, not everyone. And Reeves does really well off the bench. Starter versus bench minutes. As a reserve, he's getting 28 minutes. Now, as a starter, he's getting 32. So a few fewer minutes, but he's putting up an extra point and a half. He's getting an extra assist. He's getting an extra board. He's now shooting 63% true shooting. He was shooting 52% true shooting. Like, all of the numbers, he plays so much better. It's so much more fluid, captaining that bench lineup, having the ball in his hands, as opposed to kind of hanging out in the corner and running up and down the court, not being an effective weapon.
Yeah, and we saw his best minutes came not last regular season, but last playoffs. And the difference was that the Lakers put the ball in his hands and let him run the offense and let him create. And that was when he was able to really succeed. And start of this season, like you say, he's the fourth ball handling option in the starting lineup. Move him to the bench, give him all the positions, the usage jumps up, his efficiency goes up, and the team is able to perform better both from a starting perspective and from a bench perspective.
Yeah. And now, I mean, the only real question is who had a better flu game, him dropping 20 points in the first half of last night or Michael Jordan? I mean, Michael Jordan wasn't in an in-season tournament championship game. That wasn't a do-or-die moment. He could have lost.
That's just the regular NBA playoffs.
Yeah, like finals, but it wasn't game seven. He could have lost and still won the series. That game didn't
matter. Not to mention, it was in Utah. Like, this is Las Vegas. This is a much bigger stage. Yeah, the lights are brighter.
Oh, God.
You almost did it with a straight face.
someone will take that argument seriously somewhere, but
aren't you glad that, like, you know, the fortune, fame, power, influence, there are all these great things that come with being like a Bill Simmons caliber of podcaster, but aren't you glad that, like, you're not at the level where someone can just take that clip and destroy you on the internet for saying that?
Yeah, the, like, hey, misattributing a joke or something heavily steeped in sarcasm where you go listen to it again, you're like, did he really say that? You're like, oh yeah, he did, but that's completely out of context. Well, are you ready to add some context to the Toronto Raptors?
Let's do it. Team of the week. We need a little jingle for team of the week. Maybe I'll have to work on that.
Team of the week, the Toronto Raptors. We watched them play this week. They went 0-2. I was very hopeful that they were going to get that comeback in the second game.
Mm.
They did not. How are we feeling? What are your takes?
Yeah, I mean, just so we've got the context, the Toronto Raptors are currently 9-13, which is good for the 11th seed in the Eastern Conference. They have a 111.5 offensive rating. This is clean of the glasses stats, which is 25th in the league, so they're very bad on offense. And a 113.7 defensive rating, which is 11th, which is kind of decent. And so the thing for the Toronto Raptors, I think, the biggest thing is the callback to my finance degree and those first year basic principles. It's the principle of diminishing marginal returns. The more power forwards you add to a team, each additional power forward adds less value. When you've got no power forwards and you add a power forward, that's really useful. When you've got two power forwards already in the starting lineup and then you add a third, at a certain point, not only are you not adding value, but you're also taking it away. And the way that the Raptors struggle the most is creating efficient shots. They are actually quite good at getting to the rim. They get there a lot. They are 8th in the league at getting to the rim and 9th in the league at finishing there. So they do get there. But scoring in twos is not a good enough way, unless you're the Lakers in the finals, to get to a good offense. You need some three-point shooters. They have two guys on the entire roster who are above average shooters for their position. And ironically, Scotty Barnes, who has become a fairly competent shooter, and OG Anunoby. You've got Gary Trent, who shoots sort of a decent percentage, but as a two guard, 35.7% is not that high compared to other players at his position. And so the big thing as you watch them is they are working really hard to create offense. They do actually have a pretty decent, I think, scheme or flow. Like, watching them, they are moving, you know, like, they do get that churn going. Mm-hmm. They're setting back screens, they're getting cutters going to the rim, they're making good passes on the short roll. But everything is going at the rim. There's not a lot of spacing, and scoring in twos when you are last in the league in three-point percentage, it's just not going to get you to a very good offense.
I will say, on the flow note, as far as guys doing off-the-dribble pull-ups, up shots, they are 27th in the league as far as attempts go. They're also 27th in the league in effective field goal percentage on that. So not the best at shooting off the dribble or shooting pulling up, but they do really limit those attempts. And that is both good and bad when I'm watching them play, because, like, Scotty can try to do some stuff, but as you said with Pascal there, it limits the floor spacing. And I think that's a big trouble for them, where both Pascal and Scotty Barnes don't really make life easier for each other. And Pascal, I guess, when he posts up or drives, and you saw it against Charlotte, when he's posts up and drives, he can find Scotty. If Scotty posts up or drives or tries to do anything off the dribble, Pascal's just crowding the area. There's no help. He's not making life easier. And if you play them next to Poeltl, then you have another guy crowding that spacing. And so you really do need to do a lot of cutting. You cannot have an offense built around an individual. Just kind of for comparison's sake, they're doing 17 pull-up shots a game. The Dallas Mavericks are doing 27 a game. The Raptors are hitting 40% effective field goal. The Mavericks are hitting 51%. So Dallas having a competent ISO scorer in Luka and in Kyrie, they're able to have these guys dribble into, take their jump shots, create their own stuff. The Raptors do not have the ability to do that either efficiently or at a high volume. I think that hurts them when the game gets close.
Yeah. And I do think that there is some, you know, obviously it's not good because you'd rather have guys that can create those shots and convert them. But I do think that the fact that they take fewer pull-up shots is probably a good thing. And if we're, you know, the Raptors brought in a new head coach this season from outside of the organization. And if we look at what he has changed, it is less self-created jump shots. They went from 7th in the league at long mid-range shots last year to 22nd this year. And they're redistributing those shots in the Morey Ball fashion, taking more threes. Even though they're not going down well, it's still good to take more threes and get into the rim more. But if we were to point at one big difference in their play style under how would you pronounce it? Yeah, let's just go with Darko. That makes it easy. I don't have to try to pronounce a soft J. Under Darko, it's less pull-up jump shots. It's less mid-range shots, which are very inefficient. Like, they took a lot of mid-range shots last year, but they were not good at them. They were not good shots. And they've sort of eliminated those from their playbook in favor of three-pointers. And even though they are really bad at three-pointers, they're shooting 33.1%, which is the worst in the league. The expected value on a 33% three-pointer is better than a 40% two-pointer. And so moving those bad mid-ranges out to still pretty bad threes is still an improvement.
Mm-hmm. And if we want to specifically look at above the break threes, they're shooting 32.8%. Couldn't get the three in front of there. So I mean, basically 33 on above the break threes, but that's 28th in the league. And that is where teams shoot the highest volume of their percentage. Here's threes. That is where teams are shooting 20 to 25 threes a game. And that's right where the Raptors are at. And it's just, it's not good. Another thing that I noticed watching them play is I love Schroeder getting in there. He's small, he's fast, he's pesky and fun to watch, but he's not a good passer. And the numbers do kind of bear this out of him getting into the lane and then struggling to find someone. The Raptors average less than 1 point per possession. They average 0.79 points per possession on pick and roll attacks when the ball handler shoots. So when Schroeder gets in there, tries to score, you're giving up points. They do average fourth best in the league, 1.29 points when the big man or when the roller gets the ball and shoots. But once again, they're only shooting less than 5 of those a game. They're not hitting their bigs on the rolls. Guards are shooting the ball handler 14 shots, the roller 5 shots per game for the Raptors. And they're just not good at finding those guys once they take the screen roll.
Yeah, and they don't have anyone who scores efficiently outside of Scotty and OG, who's not, who continues to take small steps forward in self-creation, but is mostly a dependent player. The one guy that actually scores efficiently when he does shoot is Jakob Poeltl, who has a very simple role. This guy cannot do anything outside of 3 feet and doesn't try to. His role is finish at the rim, and he does it very efficiently. Like you were saying, when they do find him and he does manage to get an open shot on the roll, he is a very efficient finisher. When all he's got to do is put it in the basket from 3 feet out, he's 7'1". It's not that difficult to put the ball in the hoop when you're right there. But on Schroeder, he, as your point guard, is a poor offensive initiator in the half court. I think that he actually does provide some offensive benefit in the fact that he is so willing to run. And I've got the number here somewhere. There we go. The Raptors are third in the league in the frequency of running off of live rebounds. And so the way that they are able to get good offense is through transition. And that has been true since the Nick Nurse days. You know, going back to previous years, they were really bad on offense, but they managed to juice it by getting into transition. And so now they are running all the time off of live rebounds. Siakam is really good as a grab-and-go guy. You know, Scotty as well likes to take the ball and run in transition. And they're not just doing it often, but they're doing it really quite well. So they're third in the league in frequency off of rebounds, and they're also third in the league in scoring points per possession in transition. Their offensive rating goes from 111 to 135 when they're in transition. And so the one way that they are actually able to create good offense is by getting out and running, and they're doing it off of a lot of rebounds. One thing that's different in their defensive makeup this year is last year they really tried to force a lot of turnovers, and this year that is less of a focus. And it seems like Darko's main focus is now not giving up three-pointers where they're allowing fewer threes, which, you know, Nick Nurse knew that with this flawed roster construction, the only way to get to a passable offense was running at every chance, and that affected their defense negatively. Players were selling out constantly trying to get steals because that was the only way that they could score. Darko has lessened that. There's less playing in the passing lanes. There's more staying solid. They almost never leave a corner shooter. They don't help off, you know, you'll never see them help off the strong side. They will give up a layup before they'll give up a corner three. But not playing in those passing lanes negatively affects their offense.
Speaking of their defense, how did you feel about Scottie Barnes and like his individual defense watching those games? Because I hated it. There was a lot of times where they put him on guards, and like it was Kyle Lowry was getting around the pick and roll, and Scottie was just like, "Oh, I've been screened. Let me just chase you from behind now," but like slowly, like an adult in a Disney movie chasing a child.
Yeah. Like, yeah, he made some big shots, Lowry did, down the stretch when he was guarded by Scotty. And on his individual defense, I think he suffers from this like long wing syndrome where guys of that similar build, if you just go at them one-on-one in an ISO, like they're going to do fairly well. Like this, they cover a lot of ground with their arms. They can get up and contest. But as soon as you put them in a screen, it's a lot of body to get around the screen. And I agree with you that that is where his defensive deficiencies really show, is you just put him in a screen and he's not getting over it. And they don't necessarily have the personnel to deal with that. They want to, in theory, be playing a drop coverage because they've got Jakob Poeltl as their big man to defend the rim. Like I was saying, they try to, you know, sort of funnel things towards the rim in a way, but that's really hard to do when you're going 2-1 as the big man.
Yeah, I started to dig into some lineup data because I was like, you know, hey, the Scotty and Pascal combo doesn't look great out there. And yeah, it didn't bear out to be great. They're negative with those two guys on the court. They're actually negative with their entire starting lineup on the court. So they've played 252 minutes with the five starters out there. They've only played 37 with the five starters all off the court at the same time. So there's usually one of them still there. But in those 37 minutes with no starters on the court, they're actually a positive team, which just, you know,
Darko likes to play as guys though. So you wonder if that's, you know, when is Darko going to not have a starter out there? Maybe it's just garbage time.
could be. But still, I thought that was interesting. And looking at the Scotty OG or Pascal OG numbers, all of those look good. If you put OG with one of those two, it makes more sense. Playing like a slightly more traditional lineup, like let's get a second guard in there. A lot of the Gary Trent numbers look much better. And it makes sense. When they made that comeback against the Hornets, it was Precious Achiuwa, Chris Boucher, Trent, Scotty, and then who was the fifth? OG. Yeah. And so I went and looked up that lineup, and that was the only 6 minutes that five-man unit had played together all season. They're plus 16 points per 100 possessions with that five-man lineup. And this is the first time we've seen it. It was a good lineup. Boucher provided spacing. Trent provided spacing. OG and Scotty could space. Even Chua was hitting threes. Like, this lineup now has spacing, switchability, and you've got some Gary Trent stuff, so I don't want to step on that too much. But I appreciate his hustle and his energy. Like, you know, the Raptors were top of the league in deflections a few years back, and Gary Trent was either, like, one or two. It was, like, him and Fred VanVleet were, like, the two best guards at deflecting the ball. Having him out there does really help juice the fast break numbers and helps juice the offense.
And yeah, the stat that you were teasing is, I was looking at the lineups even before they were our team of the week, just because I'm a sicko and I go into these random things for some reason.
For fun.
For fun, yeah. Seeing how the Toronto Raptors five-man lineups fare. And the, like you're saying, starters, bad. Cannot score. Mediocre, you know, decent-ish at defense, but cannot score. Take Scotty Barnes out and put Gary Trent in, and all of a sudden the offense becomes really kind of decent. And so I dug into that, and they shoot a slightly higher percentage, very slightly. They turn it over just as much. This is a really bad turnover team. They turn it over just as much. They draw, you know, still very few free throws. This is a team that doesn't get to the line. But when Gary Trent is in, for some reason, their offensive rebound rate increases substantially. And that is the main driver of that five-man lineup of the starters, but with Barnes out and Gary Trent in, getting to decent offense. And, you know, I tried to think about why that was, and I joked that I was going to be watching this week Gary Trent's offensive box outs to see how they're able to get these rebounds. And ultimately, the conclusion that I came to, my hypothesis is, spacing not only affects your first shot, it also affects your rebounding. When you've got Siakam, Scotty Barnes, Dennis Schroeder, Jakob Poeltl, all these guys that teams don't respect, their defenders are going into the paint, and that means that it's more contest for offensive rebounds. When you go to Gary Trent, the Raptors shoot more three-pointers. The floor is more spaced. You get more of those perimeter players out on the perimeter, which makes it a more difficult job for the big man to box out Jakob Poeltl, who's quite a good offensive rebounder, or, you know, a Siakam who's you know, can be active there as well.
It also kind of clarifies the pecking order. You know, one thing I did when I coached high school, which is something that I can only imagine people did more when they coach at higher and higher levels. I learned this when I was working with MSU, Michigan State coaching staff. It was like, you should coach guys on who goes and gets rebounds and who gets back. And so, like, one of the secrets of the triangle offense is that it aligns players so that way there are always two guys kind of back to help stop the fast break. And it's flowing your offense into your defense. And when you have both Pascal and Scotty out there, and you have this overlap in positions where no one quite knows where to stand, where to space, hey, we've got a lot of guys caught in the mid-range. Oh, we should get back. We think we should be the guys to get back instead of going in. When you pull Scotty, and now it's just Pascal and Poeltl, all right, let's go get it. Let's go get these boards. Other thing could just be some of the other personnel. Chris Boucher, Precious Achiuwa are guys who bring a lot of energy off the bench. They only play if they bring energy. So they may just be a little bit more aggressive in getting rebounds. Now, you said starters plus Trent minus Barnes. So that's not going to be the case there. But when you watch the bench units play, Precious brings a ton of energy. And so overall, you could see that rebounding. But I think clarifying the roster, clarifying the lineups would make a lot of sense, which leads me to the only conclusion that I can find is they need to trade Pascal Siakam.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Like, that's the way forward. Like, this team isn't going anywhere. They're not bad enough to get a really high draft pick. They need to make a move. And I think Siakam is the guy who makes, you know, is in a vacuum, maybe the best overall player, but who makes the least sense in this roster and in this lineup, and is been, you know, having his role more limited as they turn over to trying to empower Scotty. And that hasn't gone well for Siakam. As his role's diminished, so too has his efficiency, where, you know, you don't want both of those things to coincide. And so, yeah, I think trading Siakam for someone that can shoot is sort of the best way forward. Like, if you got, like, DeAndre Hunter and Bojan Bogdanovic and some picks, like, doesn't that make this team better this year, but also going forward?
Absolutely.
Having guys who can shoot, who play a clear position that is different than Scottie Barnes, I think improves them in the short term, even though you're going from Siakam, who's a guy who's, I think, has been all NBA before, and going to a more traditional role player type of level. Having a guy who can shoot and fills that specific role, I think, would improve them.
Both this season and next. I 100% agree. I was trying to figure out some trade scenarios. Atlanta was one. I'm hoping maybe they got some buyer's remorse on Murray and you could try to get him out of there. The spacing wouldn't be great with him and Barnes, but as far as overall talent and like point of attack defense, if you've got DeJounte Murray there, like that'd be fantastic. And then Barnes doesn't have to guard guards anymore and looks better on that end. My other two options are a Pacers package, which would end up being a lot of picks, probably also Buddy Hield, just make salaries work so you get some shooting.
Yeah.
Or I think a sneaky one is, what about the Thunder? I mean, the Thunder are sitting on a treasure trove of picks. They have several young names that you could put in to like maybe jumpstart the youth movement as well. And if there is a way to get Isaiah Joe, just that level of 3-point shooting would be phenomenal. I mean, I'm guarding him as closely as I can if I'm the Thunder. But also, you get Pascal, Chet, Shea. That's a conference finals contender. That is one leap away from Jalen Williams from being a title contender for the next 2-3 years. Like, they have the spacing and playmaking around him that Pascal's limitations as a shot blocker, limitations as a scorer outside of the paint and outside of the transition really go away. So I'm kind of keeping an eye out for that one.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like a good fit because the role that you, all of the players that you need around Siakam to really let him be the best version of himself is you need a well-spaced floor. And even if you could get like some Shea Siakam staggering where you let Siakam play that SGA role in the second unit where you've still got a five out lineup at pretty much all times, you know, Mark Daigneault loves to play big men who can shoot to keep the floor space, to keep driving opportunities open. And so that's like the kind of system that he thrives in. And if we're talking about the Raptors roster construction, outside of Pascal being duplicative of Scottie's skill set, the major issue, I think, is Jakob Poeltl has been a disappointment. Offers absolutely nothing on offense outside of finishing easy shots. And the reason that they brought him in and paid him all this money was for rim protection, which he hasn't been able to offer. The Raptors allow 65.9% shooting at the rim when Poeltl is in, which is 45th percentile.
Mm-hmm.
And when they've built the scheme that I was mentioning of not overhelping, not allowing corner shooters, and funneling towards the rim, when your center, who you've just paid $20 million a year, is allowing 66% shooting at the rim, it's just not going to work. And one of the reasons that I was high on the Raptors coming into the season is I thought they'd be a bad offense and a good defense. And the reason that that's wrong and the reason that they're not a good defense ultimately isn't Scottie, it isn't Pascal, it isn't OG, it isn't Dennis Schroeder. The biggest defensive issue is that they don't have good rim protection. They allow a lot of shots at the rim by their scheme and they don't have guys who can clean it up. Poeltl allows, like I said, 66%. Precious, who's their most used backup center, allows 68%. Chris Boucher, who plays a lot of center minutes, also 68%. When the teams are able to get to the rim, the Raptors aren't able to stop those shots, which is why their defense hasn't been good. And that was the only way that they were going to be a good team.
They got to bring back Christian Koloko. I don't know what he's doing. I don't know how he hasn't played this whole year. I guess he's been dealing with a respiratory issue. That's no timetable for return. But last season, big, athletic, lots of hops. You know, barely touched the court for them until the end of the year. So if you didn't watch Christian Koloko play, you're just not a Raptors sicko. I don't know what to tell you. But he could do a lot for them, and he is the exact type of player of a shot blocking, rim running big that would pair well with Schroeder, as well as covering for the other guys, covering for Siakam and whatnot when they're not protecting the paint. But I'm not gonna let Scotty quite off the hook yet. He is too damn good to be as apathetic as he is defensively and fighting through those screens. Like, I just need more from him. I need him to try harder. I need more effort. because that length wingspan, or change up the scheme. You know, hey, if he's not going to fight through them, switch. He can guard a big, be fine. Just there's options.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe some, you know, improving their offensive scheme helps him to have that defensive energy. Getting over a screen is like all about effort. The guys who are worst at getting over screens are the guys who just don't want to. You know, you look at the likes of like a James Harden, for example. That man has never gotten over a screen in his entire life because he just doesn't care. As soon as he's a screen, he's like, all right, someone else's problem now. Yeah, I got screened. It's energy and it's effort. If the offense is easier, where Scotty isn't just running into a brick wall trying to create everything on offense every time, maybe that gives him better opportunity to focus in more defensively. Probably not, but it's an idea.
We'll find out. All right, you ready for spinning the wheel for next week's team of the week?
Yeah, I'll just say one more thing. And in conclusion, Masai Ujiri, do something. Like, you've got this reputation, you've got all this money. I think they gave him like an ownership stake is the way that they got him to resign. Like, freaking do something.
Yeah, yeah. Quit sitting on it. All right, team of the week. Here we spin. Go. The 76ers, Philadelphia. You ready for some Tobias Harris love?
Let's go, baby. Hopefully we get more than two games out of them too. Like when we selected the Raptors, I was like, oh, I can't wait to watch some Raptors games, and they played like twice the entire week. But we get to start out with them absolutely destroying the Washington Wizards tomorrow.
Oh, so easy victory. We'll get to talk about a game one for once.
Yep. Then they got the Pistons.
Okay.
Who they should destroy as well. And they've got the Pistons again. And so they are going to go through, and then they got the Hornets on a second of back-to-back. And so
listen,
maybe not the most representative sample, but we'll get to see the level of domination that Tobias Harris can reach.
I'm going to throw this out there. We do this live. We spin the wheel. What if we spun it again? What if we said, you know what, we really wanted to get a more exciting team. Is that... That may be agreeable because that schedule is rough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we need to make this fair though. Okay. So here are the qualifiers of if we can re-roll. Okay. We can re-roll if a team plays the Pistons twice in 1 week.
I think that's fair. Also,
do you think that's the only rule?
I have another rule, which we're eliminating teams as they get eliminated from the playoffs. So we will not do this spin in March and pick the Pistons. I'm sorry. We might get the Pistons now. I would be fine. We could deep dive the Pistons. We can talk about all their young players.
Watch them get destroyed by the Sixers twice.
Yeah. You know what? Screw it. We're sticking with the 76ers.
All right.
I say this knowing that I won't be here next week. So you and Aaron have 76ers.
Aaron and I are men of integrity. We will be watching the Sixers get absolutely... whatever they want against the Pistons and against the Hornets and against the Wizards. We could see Joel Embiid score 200 points in a week.
Yeah. Yeah. He might even be able to take a day off in there too.
Yeah, I mean, second of back-to-back against Charlotte, that seems like a good time to rest.
Yeah. I
mean, which means we get B-ball Paul minutes.
Ooh. All right.
Let's go.
I'm going to be in Ohio. I can actually watch these games. I won't have the local blackout. It'll be nice.
Yeah, but, so yeah, tune in next week for a B-Ball Paul breakdown.
Perfect. Dylan, where can people find you in between here? What's going on?
You can see me on Nate's TikTok.
I tag you. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe one day I'll get around to doing something.
Listen, if we can get 500 people to follow Dylan before he makes a TikTok, he will make a TikTok.
Oh, yeah, that's not going to happen, but...
Which part? Wait, 500 people following you, or you making one after you get 500 people to follow you?
Oh, the 500. I'll definitely make it if I get 500 followers. How many do you have to get before they'll start paying you? Is it like 10,000?
10,000.
Okay, yeah. If I can get 10,000 people to follow my TikTok where I don't post anything.
I post a lot. I still haven't hit that. Aaron's the only one making money off this. Him and Jen.
Yeah.
Come on.
That's all right. He pays our salary.
All right. You can find me here. You can find me on TikTok. Email us, hoopstuff@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And go watch some 76ers basketball this week.